Today's daf in Masechet Gittin, brought to you from Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh, is daf Mem Chet. And I would also like to please ask everyone that we should learn L'Zecher, my grandfather, the Rosh Shiva, Rav Ruderman, Rav Yaakov Yitzchak, and Rav Yehuda Halevi. Today we begin 10 lines down at the Tashma. So we've been talking about the machlokas between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish about what the din is about Kinyan Perot. Our opinion, Kinyan Perot, are they the equivalent of Kinyan Aguf or not? So remember what that means. Somebody purchases the rights to the produce of a field, and now the question is, does that give him actual Kinyanim in that field or not? The nafkamina that we've been talking about over here would be Lagabe, the halacha of Havaz Bikurim. And if you bring Bikurim, if you own the karka that you bring the Bikurim from, so then you say the special psukim that are supposed to be said as you present the Bikurim, and in those psukim it mentions Ha'adama Shenatata Liyashem. So we thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the land which was given to us. Now, if you don't own the land, you cannot say those words, and therefore you bring the Bikurim, but you don't actually read Mikra Bikurim. So that's a big difference. If you own the land, technically, because of the fact that you own the Peros, and that gives you actual kinyanim in the land, so then you have to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the land that he gave you. Mashenken, if you only owned the Perot, even though you owned the schus of the Perot in the land, it's still only considered to be that you owned the Perot, which is what Reish Lakish holds, then you would bring the Bikurim, but you would not say the Mikra Bikurim. So this, we had the whole discussion about relating it to the din of Yovel, that when you own a field during the time of Yovel, even when you buy a field, that field is only yours as Kinyan Perot, because in the end, the Torah is going to take the field away from you, the actual body of the field, to give it back to the person that was his Nachal. So those were the issues that we had spoken about yesterday. Toshma. Here we have another raya, because it says Hakone Ilan Vikarka O Imo. Now the halacha is like this: someone who buys a tree, if he buys one tree or two trees, then the land in between the trees is not automatically considered to be his because of the purposes of nourishment, and he would be able to bring his tractor in there and to be able to pick all the perot of the tree and so on and so forth. Unless he specifies, I'm buying the tree and the rights in the ground to the tree for anything that the tree requires. And also, in the event that he buys three trees, he automatically gets the ground in between. So now the question would be like this. Somebody who comes along and he says that he's buying the tree, and he also buys not only the tree, but he buys the rights to the ground that it was necessary for that tree. So the halacha over there is, mevi v'kore. Now there, even though the land is going to be given back to the original owner when Yovel comes about, nonetheless, it says, mevi v'kore. So that proves that even though you only have a kinyan peirot, in this case, the peirot of the trees themselves and the peirot that grow on the trees, but the bottom line is, that you are still able to say Adam Hashana Tata Liyashem, which proves that a Kinyan Perot is Kinyan Aguf, which is exactly what Rabbi Yochanan holds. How does Reish Lakish explain that away? Well, who's to say that Mishnah is talking about Bizman Shah Yovel Nohik? Maybe that Mishnah is in Bikurim, by the way, of course, we're all of the rise that we've been bringing. That Mishnah is talking about Bizman She'ein HaYovel Nohek. Okay, how about this Mishnah, also from Bikurim? HaKonesh Nei Ilanot B'toch Sadeo Shel Chaviro. So somebody who buys two trees in a friend's field is Bevi Veino Kore. Why is that? Because if you only bought two trees, then you do not have any rights to the land at all. But Mashma, that if you had purchased three, what would be the din? that since the halacha is that when someone buys three trees, he gets the rights to the land between the trees, so long as those trees are there, so then he would, in fact, be kore. Why? If that land is going to be given back to the owner at Yovel, so then he only owes the peirot. The only explanation is that the Mishnah is basically backing up Rabbi Yochanan Shita. And it's saying that in the event that you would actually own the land during the period of the Yovel, true, but only up to the Yovel, but which is Kinyan Peres, but that's still enough to be maybe Vekore. And of course, Reish Lakish gives the same answer. Hokinami bizman she'ena Yovel noeg. That Mishnah Bikurim could be talking about also not during the period of the Yovel. Now, even though that sounds a little bit forced, the truth is that now we know that we don't have to force it like that. Why? Because now that Rav Chisda said that the entire machlokas between Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish is only from after the first time that Yovel was actually practiced. So in other words, during the original Yovel, it was different. It's only from the second time on. Why would it be different during the original Yovel? Because the truth is that Yovel is a rather drastic kind of halacha. And the question is, does anybody believe it? You've been in this field for 50 years. Family has lived here. Parents lived here. Grandparents lived here. And now what, you really believe that that field is suddenly going to be given back to somebody else that was originally part of his Nachala in Eretz Yisrael? Well, it took the actual event to persuade people that this is real, baby. This is actually going to happen. So during the first time of the first 50 years after they started counting the Yovel, it wasn't part of the psychology of people when they bought fields to think that they're not really the owner of the field. From the second time on, then we get into the machlokas. Rabbi Yochanan says that even though all you have is clearly only the rights to the sada, to the peiros of the sada, and you know it, but the rights to a peirot of a sada is the equivalent of the rights of the sada. Vashenkin, according to Reish Lakish, once you know psychologically that you're not in there, so then you don't have that connection to the sada that a baalim has, and in which case you cannot say the Mikra Bikurim, where you thank the good Lord for giving you this land. You don't feel that it's your land. So that would be the explanation. You could always say that since Rav Chisda said Machloket B'Yovel Sheni between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish from the second Yovel on, but during the first 50 years after the beginning of the count of Yovel, which was 14 years after the Knesset to Eretz Yisrael when the Nachala was complete, that during that time, even Reish Lakish agrees that may be the Kore. Why? Because people didn't really believe that this was going to happen. So when the person sold his land and the other person bought the land, they really felt that they were dealing with the actual body of the land. So there Reish Lakish would be by that. If that's the case, then we don't have a problem. Because the two Mishnayot, according to Reish Lakish, were indeed talking about even during the Yovel, but only during the first Yovel. That's already not a problem, because basically, what are you trying to say in the Mishnah? That I don't want to get into the Yovel question, right? I'm just telling you what the din is. So since it's certainly true that even during the period when Yovel was knowing, at least if it was the first Yovel, this would be a correct halacha, I don't need to start explaining to you when it's a Kenyan Peirot. Obviously, if it's a Kenyan Peirot, then you're not Kore. That Reish Lakish takes for granted. And since it's possible for there to be a blanket statement, whether Yovel is Noyeg or whether Yovel is not Noyeg, it would be maybe the Kere. So therefore, it's not really a problem of Reish Lakish, because we could always understand it to be referring to the first period after the Knesset La'aretz. Now, here's an interesting question. If we ever, remember, can trace back a machloket Amoraim to a similar machloket among Tanaim, we consider that to be very problematic, because then why in the world would the Amoraim pretend that they've raised this issue when this was a machloket that had taken place generations before? Doesn't make any sense. So we always ask that as a question. That's called lema ketanoi. Shall we say that the Machlokas Rish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan was actually a Machlokas earlier? Where do we have this Machlokas? Now, gentlemen, it's a little bit complicated, so I'm going to explain it to you outside, and then we'll see it inside. It's not difficult at all. You just need to get your facts straight. So let's make sure that we get our facts straight. What is the din of someone who gave Hegdesh, he made his field Hegdesh? So the halacha is like this. During the time that we have the Yovel, so if he gave the field to Hegdesh and it was his own steachuza, something that he had inherited and it's been in the family, so then the halacha is that he is able to be poda that field, but only up until the time that the Gizbar doesn't sell it. And if the Gizbar sold it, and then somebody else has bought it, and this person does not pay Hegdesh for it, then what happens is that when it turns Yovel, the field goes to Hegdesh. And then afterwards, it's split up among the Kohanim, and it's never returned to him, which is a disaster, because then he loses his stay achuza. And that's the end of his achuza. I don't understand why it seems that everybody is muted, and nonetheless, there's noises coming in. I don't get it. But I see everybody is muted. What? You're not hearing any noises? Okay. Fine. That's the din of a stay achuza. Now, the din of a stay mikna is that if you had purchased the field and you gave it to Hegdesh, now obviously you cannot give to Hegdesh more rights than you yourself have in that field. The only rights that you had in that field were the rights to keep it until Yovel. So you can't give it to Hegdesh for Hegdesh to keep after Yovel. That would be ridiculous. So the halacha over there is that once Yovel comes around, it's returned to the original Nachala, to the person who had sold it to you in the first place. And now the question is, how do we precisely define the difference between a stay achuza and a stay mikna? So, let's assume, it's an interesting question, a child, a son, buys a field from a father during the time that Yovel is noheg. So as long as he purchased it, he owned Yaakov. Ah, now I've discovered where the noise is coming from. There we go. All right. So as long as he purchased it in that fashion, it has a din like anybody else who purchased it from his father, right? It is a stay mikna. Now, he goes ahead and he gives that stay mikna to Hegdesh. During the period of the next years where he's waiting for the field to be returned, his father dies. Now he inherits that field. But when it was given to Hegdesh, it was given to Hegdesh as a standard stay mikna. It happened to be that he was the son, the buyer was the son of the original owner of the field, who now becomes the equivalent of the original owner in the field, because now he inherited it. Now the question is, at the end of the Yovel, if he didn't buy it back from Hegdesh, does it go back to his father, meaning to him, because now he is the heir of his father? Or have we switched the identity of this field in mid-Yovel to be considered a stay achuza, since currently it's a stay achuza, and therefore he would lose the field and it would go out to Hegdesh as if when he had made it Hegdesh, as if it had been at that time stay achuza? Okay? Is that clear what the issue is? Fine. Now, that does not have direct bearing on the question of kinyan peres kinyan aguf, but it does have indirect bearing if we examine it as follows. And let's take a look now that we have our details clear. Let's take a look at the Gemara. Minayin lelokech sadeh mi'aviv. So here it says in a braita, huh? How do we know that if somebody bought a field from his father, so he's now a standard buyer of the rights to Perah, right? Because the field's going to be given back to his father in Yovel, assuming that his father lives till Yovel. He bought his Sada from his father, and he made it Hegdesh. Then his father died before Yovel. Says the Braita, how do we know, Minayin, How do we know that it actually turns into a steyachuza? And if he does not pay it back, and meaning he's not paid at, and the gizbar sells it to someone, that's it. It goes out to the Kohanim in Yovel, and he's going to lose this as a steyachuza, because it became a steyachuza, even though when he gave it to Agdash, it wasn't a steyachuza. Talmud Lomar, look at this fascinating pasuk. In et sedei miknato, asher lo mistei achuzato. Weird pasuk. If a person had given his sedei mikna, which was not his stei achuza, well, obviously, if it's a stei mikna, of course it's not his stei achuza. Why would the Torah write those extra words, asher lo mistei achuzato? I mean, if he had had to buy it, obviously, it wasn't his Yerusha, it wasn't his Nachala, correct? Ah, brilliant. This is coming to tell me that if that field could have been a Steyachuz, isn't that beautiful? Imistei Miknato, which is not ever meant to be Sideyachuzato, that's what the Pasuk is saying, which implies that if it became the Steyachuz, even though he had already given it over as a stei mikna, now that it's a stei achuza, it is not called a stei mikna anymore, it's called a stei achuza. And therefore, it will go out to the Kohanim. So yatzta zu, and therefore that excludes this case where the child had given this sada that he had originally bought as a stei mikna, when he gives it, and then it turns into a stei achuza, it is not called a stei mikna, because it was a stei mikna that was mistei achuza. And the only dinim of stei mikna asher lo mistei achuza. What a beautiful, beautiful diak. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda v'Rabbi Shimon. Okay, now, the problem here, so far this has nothing to do with our sugya. It's just a lovely diak in the pasuk. Now, Rabbi Meir says, now, you boys have gone too far. Because you can't jump to that case based on this pasuk. Because, look, I say the pasuk, you're right, 100%, it's a beautiful diag, but you don't have a right to take it that far. What would be the din like this? Somebody buys a soda from his father, and then his father dies, and then he makes it hegdash. And now the question is, does that have a din of a steyachuza? Because at the time that he made it hegdash, he had already inherited it. Or does it have a din of a stei mikna, because the way in which it became his initially was not through the death of his father, but was rather through a standard purchase? Comes along the pasuk to tell me, how do I know that if he was magdish it only after the father died, not before, like you guys are saying, only after the father died, how would I know that then it has a din of a stei achuza? Talmud lomar, im et stei mikna toa shalom mi stei achuza to. This means only where the soda is currently not a steyachuza. Yatztazo, which is currently a steyachuza. She's steyachuza, despite the fact that at the time that it came into his rishus, it had come into his rishus as a stey mikna. Now, obviously, the reason that Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon are not very persuaded that we need the pasuk to tell me Rabbi Meir's case is because, well, obviously, if now his father died, and now he owns the field as a Yerusha, why would I need a pasuk of all things to tell me that it's called the Yerusha? Of course it's called the Yerusha. Why do I care about the fact that initially he had purchased it and was therefore only a Kenyan Peres if now he already owned the actual goof of the Karka because he inherited his father? What's going on? So I'll tell you what's going on. So according to Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, in the case where the father died and then he was magdashit, of course I don't need a pasuk. So why does Rabbi Meir need a pasuk? Now we suddenly discover the brilliant relevance of this machlokas between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon to our sugya. What would be if Rabbi Meir would hold that actually the original kinyan that the son had of the Kenyan Peres from his father while his father was alive? What if Rabbi Meir would hold that that Kenyan Peres is a Kenyan Aguf, like Rabbi Yochanan? Then the father goes and dies. nothing changed. He always had a Kinyan HaGuf in this field, and therefore at the time of the father's death, why would it change its status to be called a Stei Achuza if anyway it's the same level of Kinyan as a Kinyan HaGuf? Therefore, says Rebbe Meir, I need a Pasuk to tell me that even though there's no technical change in the level of ownership, nonetheless, the very fact that it now comes to him as an Achuza means that when you give it, it has different implications vis-a-vis Yovel. Whereas Rebbe Yehuda and Rebbe Shimon says that's ridiculous. Before, he only owned the field as a Kinyan Peres because he had bought it from his father like anybody else. Now that his father died, there's a major, massive change in the nature of the ownership. He now owns the field. Before, he only owned the rights to the Perot. So I don't need a pasuk to tell me that if he currently has a Stei Achuza, of course it has a din of a Stei Achuza. We've got to be crazy to think otherwise. Therefore, what would be the meaning of that pasuk? Pasuk must be coming to tell me even if the father died after he had been Magdashit, while he has not yet, as yet, become the Yoresh and Afal Pikein. If he became the Yoresh subsequently, the field is treated as if it were a Stei Achuza all along. But that would mean that we have an ancient machlokas between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, which boils down to the same machlokas as between Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan. Is a Kinyan of Peros, in this event from the father, is the Kinyan of the Perot the equivalent of the purchase of the actual body of the field or not? And that's exactly what the discussion here is between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon. This is a little bit complicated if you're not used to the ideas. It's very straightforward and simple if you have your facts straight. So before we continue, I just want to make sure that everybody understands very clearly what's going on here. If not, please let me know that there's something unclear what needs explaining. Or forever hold your peace. Alrighty then. Sir Richard, do I get a thumbs up?
You can get a thumbs up. Is there any practical difference between the two Girsa'ot?
Which Girsa'ot? There's no Girsa'ot. You've been eating your porridge and haven't paying attention.
No, I'm not drinking my tea. It's early.
Some tea. You can pass it off as tea to people who can't smell it.
No, it's
so, that means you were not paying attention.
I was paying attention, but I seem to have tripped a little bit There are no two Girsot, Sir Richard.
You mean the two versions of the Pusik. Okay, that's what you meant. Of course, there's a tremendous practical difference. The first version that you're calling as a version, which was Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, used the pasuk to tell me that if a father died after the son made it Hegdash, that it would still be a Stei Achuza because it changed its status in mid-Yovel. The second way, which was Rabbi Meir's approach, is no. Only if the father died before the children made it Egdish, then it would be a Stei Achuza. And but that's a major difference. So therefore, it would remain a Stei Mikneh otherwise, in the case that was the original case. It makes a major difference. It's even a bigger difference than those crazy first class air tickets, for heaven's sakes. That should be made very, very clear. So I mean, you never know. You know, Ariel may want to give away the island to Hegdash one day. I mean, it's, you know. No. Okay. So therefore, yes, it makes a tremendous difference, and it seems to boil down to this question. Is a Kinyan a Peres Kinyan a Guf or not? Because otherwise, there's no excuse for Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon not to need a separate pasuk. First to tell me, stage one, is it considered to be a Stei Achuza if the father died after the purchase but before the Hegdash? First tell me that that's called a Stei Achuza. Next pasuk, Now you could tell me, what would be the case if the father died after they had already made it Hekdash as a stay mikna? Would it also be called a stay achuzah? For that, I need another pasuk. I mean, that would be a major news. Okay, so since Rabbi Shimon says you don't need another pasuk, he obviously considers the death of the father to be meaningless, because as far as the legalities are concerned, it already was a kinyan aguf. So the way that Rabbi Meir understood it, and then you would need a pasuk to tell me, so they disagree, and they hold that kinyan peres, in fact, is in the full, is not kinyan aguf. So that must be gufa, the nafkamina. Okay? So let's see that inside. So my love, welcome if we get Rabbi Meir suffer kinyan perot kinyan aguf tami. And therefore, b'ha, in this particular case, when the father dies, b'mitat aviv, u'delo yorid v'lo mide, they didn't inherit anything, technically, because it was already theirs. So therefore, even if the father died and then they were magdashid, I need a pasuk to tell me that the change vis-a-vis Yovel is significant enough to turn it into estei achuzah. Mashenken Reb Yehuda Reb Shimon hold, kinyan perot is lavka kinyan haguf, and therefore, well, obviously, that means that when the father died, they inherited it, doesn't it? It changed their ownership. So, of course, if then they go ahead and they make it Hegdash, they were Magdash, a field that is now their Nachala, and that's a Stei Achuzah. And therefore, it's only upon the death of the father, the Mitat Aviv, at that moment, it turned into his Yerusha. So, therefore, I don't need a Pasuk. Of course, it's his Yerusha. If the father died first, I don't need a pasuk. I only have one pasuk, but that pasuk is coming to tell me the single remaining case, which is the chiddush, that even if the father died after the child had made it hegdish, based on his purchase of the rights to the peres from the father, that is still considered to be a change to turn it into a stei achuzah in mid-ownership of hegdish, and if he doesn't buy it back from hegdish in time, then he loses that achuzah. So then that means that the machlokas Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish is the machlokas Tanoim. Omer Reb Nachum Bar Yitzchak, I can answer this. It's not necessarily the case. Liyola Mei Malach, Bi'alma Kasavi Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Shimon, Kinyan Piro, Kinyan Aguf Tami. It may well be that they're all agreed that Kinyan Piro, Kinyan Aguf Tami. And that, in fact, there was no change when the father died in the technicalities of their ownership. So how did they have a right to jump ahead? How did they have a right to take Rabbi Meir's pasuk and then add this additional quantum leap of saying that even if the father died after the children had made it hegdash, it would become a stei achuzah? Huh? How do you explain that? Aha! They found another pasuk, so they have two pasukim. I indeed did use this pasuk like Rabbi Meir used it, and then they found a lovely diuk which would justify their taking even the second step, namely that the father dying after the hegdash would also turn it into a stei achuzah. V'hacha Rabbi Yehuda v'Rabbi Shimon kra ashkecho, they found a pasuk and they were dorish the pasuk, because they said, look, there's not only one diuk in this pasuk, there's two diukim in this pasuk. What should it have said? Im et stei miknato. Period. Right? What are you throwing in? Asher lo b'stei achuzato. But even if you want us to be aware of the fact that this is a stei mikna that remained a stei mikna and did not become a stei achuza, why would you say the words asher lo m'stei achuzato? You should write im et stei miknato asher lo achuzato. If a person owns a stei mikna that did not become his inheritance, isn't that a perfect diuk, like Rabbi Meir says? If it became the inheritance, then it has to be treated as an inheritance. Okay, why did you throw in the extra word, a field which he bought, which is not the field that he inherited, when you could have just said, a field that you bought that you didn't inherit? Ah, that's coming to tell me an additional beautiful point to all of the Philistines out there who think they know something about reading because they got their PhD at some stinking university like Harvard or something. They don't know how to read. It should have said, "Mistei achuzato." So that tells me, "Yatzta zo shiru yali yotzte achuzah." This is a sada that could one day become a steachuza, could it not? Then that excludes even the case where, sure enough, it did become a steachuza because the father ultimately died. Excellent. Okay, so we no longer have any reason to suspect that we have a machloket tanaim about this issue. Now, says Rabbi Yosef, let me tell you something, boys. It sure is a darn good thing that Rabbi Yochanan holds that Kinyan Peres is Kinyan Aguf. Because, man, if he didn't hold that, he'd be up the creek without a paddle. It would have been so embarrassing. I mean, it's terrible to even think of. Whew, it works out perfect for him. You know why? Because Elav, the Amr Rabbi Yochanan, Kinyan Perot, Kinyan Aguf Dami, Lo Matzaya Davar Aglav Bebeit HaMidrash. He would have been flailing about. He wouldn't have been able to swim through the attacks against him in the Beis HaMedrash. Because, listen, if we put together what Rabbi Yochanan holds, he turns out to be saying something nutty. Because remember, Rabbi Yochanan holds, as we've seen many times, that brothers who inherit an estate, and then they split the estate, they are considered to be the same as buyers. Because there's two ways of understanding a split of a Yerusha. One of them is based on Breira, and one of them is based on Ein Breira. If you hold of Breira, remember that then we say that the way that things work out is indicative of what was always innate in the history of the item, right? So if it turns out that you split it, that brother A takes field X and brother B takes field Y, then that implies that at the time that the father died, those were the fields that were meant to belong to those brothers respectively. That's called Breira. If you hold of Breira, then, in fact, when Yovel comes around, every brother continues to hold on to their field because that indeed is their inheritance going all the way back to the original Yerusha Ta'aretz. But what if you don't hold of Breira? What if you hold that basically things are random and the way that they work out at the end does not imply anything about what was meant to work out at the beginning? That's how Rashi explains Ein Breira. Basically, all of reality is nothing but probabilistic, says Rashi. And what happens at the end implies nothing about what would have happened if some butterfly hadn't wiggled its wings somewhere in Africa. So therefore, how could you possibly go back in time and claim that this is what was meant to happen? Fine. Then what's the din? So then the din is that each brother has effectively exchanged whatever rights he had in the field that his brother wants in exchange for the rights that his brother had in the field that he wants. That's called barter. And barter is another form of purchase, right? So then if that's the case, what happens when Yovel comes around? Well, the din is if you just bartered for something, at Yovel, everything goes back to the way it was. And all the fields are restored to their original situation. Which means that every time Yovel comes around, these brothers are going to have to re-split the field because it went back to being the original estate. Okay, that's clear. Achim Shechoku, this happens to be Rabbi Yochanan Shita, that Achim Shechoku are actually considered to be buyers. The whole thing goes back to the way it was during Yovel. Now, let me point out to you, says Rabbi Yosef, the trouble that Rabbi Yochanan got himself into by saying this. Because, you see, if he would not also have passed that Kinyan Peres is Kinyan Aguf, let's imagine he holds Kinyan Peres is Lav Kinyan Aguf, then you tell me, bring me a person who currently lives in Eretz Yisrael who will bring Bikurim and will say Mikra Bikurim, okay? Oh, yes, it's possible. It's possible that there was a family since the time of Yoshua ben Nun that never had more than one son. So that one son inherited his one father. and then his one son inherited his one father, and his one son inherited his one father. That's the only kind of person who would ever be able to say Ha'adam Asher Natatali. But everybody else, since the beginning of time, has been giving back the field in Yovel and now coming out only with a Kenyan Peres. But if you only have a Kenyan Peres, you cannot say Ha'adam Asher Natatali. Thank heavens for Rabbi Yochanan's wise determination that a Kenyan Peres is a Kenyan Aguf. Whew. And therefore, people who own fields can bring Bikurim and can say Mikra Bikurim. So I'm just pointing out to you, said Rabbi Yosef, you may not hold a Brera, but things sure worked out good for you, Rabbi Yochanan. So you ended up with everything coming out okay. But that's the only reason why, because the old Kenyan Peres are a Kenyan Aguf. Fine. So let's see that inside. Because Isaac, if you're going to tell me that Rabbi Yochanan would hold that just having the rights to Peres, lo mashkachat demaisi bikurim, no one in history will be able to bring bikurim, meaning bring bikurim as the din requires, that he says the mikra bikurim, unless he was one son, the son of a single son, the son of a single son, the son of a single son, going all the way back to Yoshua ben Nun at the time of the Yerusha Saharas, right? Thank heavens, it works out for Rabbi Yochanan. Whew, that was close. Now, Rabosai, what is not working out at all is, as Tosis points out, Rabbi Yosef, it's all very nice that Rabbi Yochanan wasn't left flailing about on the floor in the Beis HaMedrash. But what about us? We're all left flailing on the floor in the Beis HaMedrash because we paskin like Reish Lakish that Kenyan Peres is not a Kenyan Aguf. And yet we paskin that we don't hold a Brera in a D'oraisa, which means that we paskin that the din is that you only have Kenyan Peres. And since we don't paskin like Rabbi Yochanan, we're up the creek without a paddle, because nobody can say Mikra Bikurim according to us. Ha-ha! So it's all very nice that Rabbi Yochanan has a way out. How do we have a way out? This is the way the Rabbeinu Tam phrases the question. Nice point, huh? Ay, ay, ay. Meretzach zum Wand. I'm telling you. Rebbe, wie sagt man Meretzach zum Wand in Yiddish? I'm talking to the wall. It's a beautiful problem. So Tosfos answers that no, it's not true. The Gemara is absolutely correct. Rabbi Yosef is correct in saying that Rabbi Yochanan is up the creek without a paddle. But that doesn't mean that we're up the creek without a paddle. Because the other Amoraim, other than Rabbi Yochanan, hold that even though they are lekuchot, they don't give it back in Yovel. What? That's right. Rabbi Yochanan took for granted that this is a binary issue. Either you're lekuchot or you are yorshim. If you're lekuchot, then it's going to go back in Yovel. But wait a minute. That made an assumption that others don't agree with. Explains to Rabbeinu Tam, it is not just a black and white question. The fact is that the Torah specified that only Mechira goes back in Yovel, which means Derech Mechira. If something was done in another format, because this is the way that Yerusha is done, then it would not be Chazer, even though technically speaking, it was an exchange. And therefore, it was only a problem to Rabbi Yochanan personally. But that does not mean that anybody who holds that we don't say Brera is going to necessarily hold that Achim Shechoku or Machzirim Zeb Zebiova. You see, you could press that. Achim Shechoku Lukuchotein U Machzirim Zeb Zebiova. Wait. The last piece does not necessarily follow. So it follows according to Rabbi Yochanan, does not follow according to the other Shitot, and therefore, though we pass Kinyan Peres Lavka Kinyan Aguf, and though we paskin ein brera in D'oraisas, which of course would be nogea here, but we paskin that the only din of hashava biyovel is where something was not done as part of establishing a Yerusha. Okay, now we can continue, and I hope that that little discursion was okay. Fine. All right, so continues the Gemara. I see that Rich is getting himself all ready for the big moment. I hope he's getting himself all ready for the big moment. I'm sure Zoom is going to be taking steps to ensure that it's going to be done properly. Omar Rava, Kra Umatnita. Look, it's all very nice that we have this machlokas, but if you really look at the language of the Torah, and you look at the language of the way that the Brises speak, it sure sounds a lot like Reish Lakish. Let's take a look at the way the Torah speaks about the sale of a field. B'mispar shnei tvuot yimkarlach. What is that supposed to mean? The Torah says, if you sell something, then the person would have a right to buy it back according to the number of crops that are left. Crops? What's going on over here? So what the Torah is telling you is that if there is a yovel, for all intents and purposes, everything that you've owned has only been crops, not the actual field. Ha-ha. That's exactly what Reish Lakish is saying. Look, I mean, I understand it doesn't prove anything, but you must admit, from a literary point of view, it certainly sounds mispar tvuo tumocher lach, the Torah says. He's only selling you the number of times that you'd be able to get these crops out of the field. What do you mean he sold the field? No, he didn't. That's what he seems to be saying, just like Reish Lakish. Now, let me show you the way that the Brises speak about these things. The Tanya, b'chor notel pishnayim, so here it says, in order to understand this raya, we need to remember something that I'm sure Gavi has already written down, but just in case, please, Gavi, dear, remember. Bechor eino notel b'ra'ui kibimuchzak. A bechor does not take property that comes into his father's rishus after his father's death, and that was because, let's say, somebody owed him money or something like that. And now it comes into his rishos, but he didn't have it when he died. So since the pasuk says that he should be noto pi shnai b'chol asher yimatze lo, only those things that were under the hand and in the rishos of the father at the time of his death, only those things the b'chor is noto pi shnai. Now, if, however, it comes into the rishus of the father after his death, then the bechor doesn't have any more rights than anybody else. He splits it evenly. Now, if that's the case, this next statement becomes very important. The Tanya, bechor notel pishnayim, bisadeh chozeret laviv biyovel. Oh my God, this is amazing. The father didn't have that field, and now the field is returned to the estate after the death of the father because of Yovel. What happens? The Bechor gets a double portion. Why? The father didn't have that field in his Rishus until it was returned. Wrong. He always had it in his Rishus. Because even though it was sold, it only was sold for payrot. And the father retained the Kinyan Aguf. Ha ha. Exactly what Reish Lakish says. So again, we have a clear raya from that Yovel. This din, Bechor Noto Pishnayim, is a raya to Reish Lakish. Another interesting question would be when it comes to going to court, who is considered to be relevant to the case? Now, you cannot take someone to court because you're a friend. Amicus curiae is not a reason for you to go to court in terms of the halacha. Now, in this case, a husband has nichsei malug of his wife, and somebody is claiming that actually his wife doesn't really own that nichsei malug. The husband wants to go to court on behalf of his wife. He can only go to court, says Abaye, if he gets a power of attorney. So then he's appearing as an attorney, but he's not appearing as the Baal Din. So Baal b'nichsei ishto, tzarich harsha'a, he requires a power of attorney in order to get involved in the case. Now, what does that mean? Even though, if it's nichsei malug, by definition, it is his for peirot, he's not considered to be an owner. And therefore, when he walks into court without a power of attorney, the court throws him out. They say, who are you? You have nothing to do with this case. Now, obviously, okay, so that shows what? That Kenyan Peros is not Kenyan Aguf. Again, exactly what Reish Lakish says, all right? So this is only true, of course, says Abaya. There's a very interesting and beautiful point. If the case has ramifications about his ability to collect the Peirot, then since he's able to enter the case in terms of getting his Peirot off of this claimant, he can also already become a factor in the case and present his arguments for why his wife should be able to keep the field. But that's because of Amigo. Once lo amrela de lo nachita peri, that's only if he hasn't become regarding the case, he's not going to be affected. But if he's nachita peri, if he would have to come into that case to argue for the rights to the perot, then he can already argue the case without a power of attorney. Because migo de mishtai dina apere, mishtai dina agufa. Once he's able to do that, he's able to do it also on the actual goof. Hadron alach hasholeach, and now the great moment where Zoom has put the doc right there, and he's able to just stick his hand right through there and give a knock to Richie. I don't think it goes according to your ridiculous iPad screen, Richie. The doc is... Hadron alocha shaleach. Okay. Now he's right on top. You better say it right. That's your iPad. On the correct screen, the doc has been moved directly above, as predicted by our theory that Zoom is totally sentient. And as soon as it got the moment for him to say, find on the hay like a peric, doc was put into position. Now go ahead, go argue with me, guys. What do you think? I've got some kind of control over Zoom? Man.
Well, Doc disappeared from the page. Where is he?
He feels that he has served his purpose for today. Apparently. Okay. And I won't even tell you what he's got in that little hypodermic, which is right over your head, Rich. So I'd be careful. Okay, so now we enter into a new perek, which is apparently irrelevant to our Masechet. It's going to be talking about the various ways in which collections and all kinds of crazy things that don't seem to have anything to do with Gittin. Now, the reason that this is here is because we just completed the entire perek that is discussing what? Mipnei Tikkun HaOlam. Every single Mishnah in our perek was relevant to the concept of Tikkun HaOlam as it was part of the dinim of Avadim, which, of course, is part of the dinim of Gittin Nashim. So almost every single case was nogea those issues. Now, it turns out that there's a whole other perek that is also all about Tikkun HaOlam, but over here the Tikkun HaOlam are general, vast tikkunim about the way that business is conducted and the way that people can collect. So therefore, we begin the next perek, HaNizakin, that talks to us about how it is that there are three different levels of collection that the Chachomim were metaken, and were metaken this way specifically because of Tikkun HaOlam, as we'll see. So let's remember that there are three types of objective valuations, possibly of karka, or perhaps subjective. That's going to be a question that we will be discussing. But we have three overall sets of property. We have high quality, which is called idit. We have low quality, which is called ziburit. And we have mid quality, which is called beinonit. The question of whether that's defined as a universal definition so that everyone who has that particular quality isn't has whatever it's called, or whether it's defined relative to himself, that we'll be discussing. But let's just take for granted three different types of land qualities. These different qualities make it either more or less difficult to sell that land and to move it. Now, real estate, it's not like stocks where somebody's going to buy. You've got to wait, and it's a whole hassle to get something sold. Therefore, when the Torah said that in cases where your property damaged somebody else's property, so it says in the Torah, Meitav Sadehu, Meitav Karmo Yishalem. He pays back with the best quality that he's got. That is called Idit. That is called Nizakin. So if you cause damage, you pay from the Idit. Okay. Now, what about if you owed money, you default on the loan, you don't have any cash, the guy is coming to collect money from your property, what property can he take? Can he take the best quality so he has an easy time selling it? Do you have a right to give him the lowest quality to make him hassle with the sale? Well, the halacha is that there he takes the middle quality, and that's called benonit. And what about a woman who was divorced, and now you don't have what to pay her ketuvah with? What property can she take? She takes the lowest level quality. And we're going to talk about where all of this comes from and how it's part of Tikkun HaOlam as we go through the sugya. So now let's take a look at our bright. Hanizakin. So now, if somebody has been damaged, he's now gone to court, he's demanding his damage, the guy does not have cash, and he wants to pay only from allowing me to take his property. Then Shamin Lahem Be'idit. The court takes the best quality property, assuming that that's what you're willing, what you want, and you have a right to demand it, and they estimate, they do an assessment, okay, it's going to take 30 acres of this property to be able to pay back your loan. We give the 30 acres to be sold by the Nizuk, the person who was damaged. Fine. And that is apparently a deoraita, so it doesn't make sense that we should call it a mipnei tikkun olam. It says beferish ki yivar ish sadeo keren vishilachet biro bi'er b'stei acher meitav sadehu u'meitav karmo yishalem. And the Gemara is going to be asking, what does that have to do with tikkun olam if it's a deoraita? But it's not so simple that it's a deoraita, because when the Torah says meitav sadehu meitav karmo, who is the antecedent of the pronoun? Who's Meitav? The one who caused the damage or the one who was damaged? Ah, that's a big machlokas between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel. So Rabbi Shmuel says, you have to pay the best property that the victim owns. Meaning, if you have very high quality property, and the victim says, well, I want your best quality, you would have a right, according to Rabbi Shmuel, to say, now listen here, Mr. Victim, your best quality of land is not even as good as my worst quality lands. Don't come to me hoity-toity and take my best property. I will give you my worst property, but that's still better than anything else that you got. So according to Rabbi Shmuel, that is actually the din. And you would midiraisa, and you would be able to say, you're limited in the collection by whatever is best in your property. Rabbi Akiva says, no, it means the best property of the person who's doing the paying, which means that it's Meitav Sadeo Shel Hamazik. So one way of understanding the Mishnah is that even according to Rabbi Yishmael, where normally I would have to accept the best property as limited by my own best property, we made a tikkun olam. And to see to it that people are careful about damaging and they may lose their very best, we make you pay even Alibet Rabbi Yishmael. We make you pay. Well, what about according to Rabbi Akiva? What's the Chiddush? The Chiddush is, remarkably, and this is a very big change, up until this time, Tikkun HaOlam meant that the Rabbanan changed the halacha from what it should be to make a Tikkun HaOlam. According to the Mishnah being Alibet Rabbi Akiva, it's following the Shita of Rabbi Shimon. And Rabbi Shimon says, you are meant to understand the reasoning behind a pasuk. And therefore, Rabbi Shimon is saying, why did the Torah say Meitav Sadeh or Meitav Karmo? As a tikkun olam. HaKadosh Baruch Hu meant it as a tikkun olam. It was meant to teach people to be very careful about causing damage. Fine. Those are the two approaches that we're going to see in the Gemara. U'ba'al chov, when somebody is coming to collect a defaulter on a debt, even though he would maybe midiraita only have a right to the lowest quality. Why is that? Because the Torah says if somebody comes and is coming to collect a loan, ha'ish asher ata noshebo, yotzi elecha et ha'avot achutza. You're trying to collect something, he takes it out. You can't go into his house. Don't you dare. You could stand at the door and ask the guy to bring out something to pay. Now, what's he going to bring out to pay? You think he's going to bring out the best thing he's got, or he's going to bring out the garbage that he's got? I mean, obviously, he is not going to bring you out his Tesla. He's going to bring you out his little Nash Rambler. So if that's the case, you should only be able to collect from Ziburit. But comes along the Rabbanan, and they said, that's crazy. Who's going to be willing to make loans if they're going to hassle with real estate in order to get paid back? So therefore, we will up it one, and we'll give you a right to a higher level, which is the medium, the Beinonit. And we'll see about why it's not Idit, specifically. And then when it comes to Ketuvat Isha, the woman can only collect from Ziburit. Because the only reason, remember, that in a normal loan that somebody's collecting, that we gave you the rights of Beinonit, the only reason we did that is because this is called, where's my Gavi? This is called Shalotin Ol Delet Bifnei Lovim. Shalotin Ol Delet Bifnei Lovim means we make a takona so that loans will be easy to get. Now, a woman is basically like any other borrower, so to speak, which she's collecting. You owe me money for my ketuvah. But we do not have to make the takana of making it easier to get loans for a woman. We would only have to make a takana to make marriage more palatable for a woman. But women, unfortunately for them, like getting married. And therefore, since we have the klal of tav lemetav tandu milemetav armalta, which Gavi has already written down, better to live with this idiot than to live with no one at all. So that's the thoughts that they have about getting married. So because of that, we don't have to encourage them to get married. And therefore, we put it back on the Diraita. Let him bring out to you his little Nash Rambler instead of his Tesla. Fine. Then there's a general rule that you need to know, which is that if there are properties that have not been sold to anyone else, and they are available, you cannot go and collect the property that was meant to be collected from if it was sold. Because even though you have a lien, you must first exercise your lien against the first available property, even if it's not the best and you were supposed to be able to get the best, or even if it's not the middle and you were supposed to get the middle. So, you cannot take property that had been sold to another before you went to court. And that's even if all that's left behind is the worst quality ziburit, and you are a nizak, and you have a right to edis. It doesn't matter. So we're going to see what that is all about. And we have another din, and that is that ein, there's another thing of ein nifra minichse yetomim as a tikkun olam. If the father has died, leaving the debt to be paid, whether it's a debt for damages or whether it's a debt of a loan, and now it's left on the property that belongs to the orphans, the din is that you can only collect the lowest quality if you're collecting from yetomim. That, too, is another tikkun olam, which we'll discuss. Then there's yet another tikkun olam, and that is, ein motzi'in la'achilat perot u'l'shevach karkaot v'limzona yishava abanot minechasim mishu'ubadim. You cannot collect from something that there would be no way for a buyer of a person's fields to know the amount that is going to be due and that might be collected from him. Remember that this halacha, that you could never attach a field that has been purchased by someone else unless there was no open field that had been left behind by that buyer. So let's imagine a case. A guy wants to purchase a field from you. He finds out, remember this is all part of the protection of buyers where loans are made by contract. He finds out that you have a mortgage against you for $100,000. He doesn't want to get stuck with paying your mortgage in the event that you default. So what he does is he finds out all the property that you own. He finds out that there is $100,000 of free property that would remain available for the bank to collect from. Even if he buys this piece of property, he's left behind enough to cover his rear end in the event that you default on your mortgage. That's called due diligence. So he can buy, and therefore the real estate market survives because due diligence is possible. What if we allowed people to collect monies that there's absolutely no way to predict in advance that that money would be due? Oh my God. Then the real estate market would collapse under the weight of insurance for property, right? Because I don't know. I'm going to have to pay a lot of money for insuring this purchase because who knows what kind of debts might show up in the future if they're allowed to be collected from me. We never allow those kind of debts, therefore, to be collected because we don't want to ruin the real estate market. That's called a tikkun ha'olam. Now, one of the things that we worry about are the three categories of items that are not predictable. And those are what we're talking about now. Achilat peirot, shevach karkaot, and mizon ha'isha v'habanot. You cannot collect them from the chasim mishu'abadim. You can only collect them if there is available property. What are these three things? So, achilat peirot means a guy goes ahead, he steals a field. He sells the field. He sells the field with achrayut, that if anybody comes and collects that field, you can come back to me and I will pay you anything that you paid me. So that's property insurance. Title insurance, right? Now, when I buy my field from this guy, I need to make sure that he can cover the title insurance. So I can do due diligence. I do my due diligence. Now let's imagine a case like this. I was an investor. I bought this property and I invested in the property and the property is now producing and it's got a lot of payroll on it. All of a sudden, the original owner, I never knew it belonged to another guy, comes along, proves that I was the victim of selling the Brooklyn Bridge. I bought a property that didn't even belong to this guy. And he says, sorry, buddy, calls the cops and they throw me out of the property. Now it's his property. And I'm sitting there yelling, wait a minute here. I've got $200,000 worth of crops in this property. I want my crops. So the guy, the din is like this. The guy says, okay, what did it cost you to get these $200,000 of crops? What did you invest? I figure it's $10,000 in seed, $5,000 in tractor rental. I'll pay you $15,000. But I was about to sell all of this for $200,000. That's not my problem. You go back to the guy who sold it to you and sue him. That's the din. You can go back and sue him. But since there's no way to know in advance what kind of use is going to be made out of this property, you cannot collect from property that that person who sold it to you owned, but now has sold to someone else, because that someone else would never have been able to protect himself because he has no idea of what kind of claims are going to be coming in against this field. Is this clear, gentlemen? It's wonderful. It's so brilliant. It's so aware. It's taking so much into consideration. It's such an absolutely enlightened understanding of what needs to be done to protect markets thousands of years before all of these idiots around us ever even began thinking about things. Fine. So all of this is included in the Din of Tikkun HaOlam. That's the inyan of Peirot. Now there's another thing, which is Shevach Karkaot. Suppose the guy doesn't have Peirot, but he built buildings on this property. He has planted things on this property. And now this guy had me thrown off the property. Sorry, sir, this is not your but what about all my expenses? He can collect that by suing the person who sold it to him, but only if there's property available. And we then have the third quality, which is mazona isha vabanot. You remember back in Ketuvot, we learned that if a man dies leaving an almana, she is given all of her necessary support from his property. So too, his daughters. They are also taken care of until they get married. They now go to court and they want to collect $100,000 towards all of this. This guy's already sold the fields that he had, and they're trying to collect from fields that were once his, but now belong to someone else. And that person says, well, how the heck was I supposed to know that this guy was going to die at such a young age, leaving 30 years of support for his wife, which is more than my field is even worth in the first place? I would never have bought this field. I'll never buy a field again. I don't know what's going to be coming out of the blue to hit me. Exactly. And that's why you could only collect, the almanac can only collect for the daughters, for herself, from fields that had not been sold to somebody else. And all of this is Mipnei Tikkun HaOlam. So let's just review again the Mishnah we had yesterday. And we were talking about the Nizakim. So let's read through the Mishnah again, just to remember. There are three types of property, which we call the Idit, and the Beinonit, and the Ziburit, in order of declining levels of quality. And we have three different types of payments that we have to consider. And that is for Nezek, for repayment of loans, and for payment of a ketubah. So our Mishnah now defines, as a continuation of the concept of Tikkun HaOlam, which we're going to have to see how that figures here, that these three different types of tashlumin are given three different types of property levels to collect from, even though they're all getting paid the same amount, obviously, in the end, per dollar. The question is, how much trouble do they have to go through in order to recoup in the event that the person paying does not have cash? So then if they have to sell real estate, how much trouble do they have to go through? If they get the best property, land, so then it's easy to get rid of. Obviously, there are other valuable reasons to have good property land. You might want to keep the good property land yourself, and so on and so forth. So the lower down you go, the more difficult it's going to be for them to rapidly get their money out of it. So, says the Gemara, says the Mishnah, Hanizakin Shemilan Be'idit. Ba'al Chov, you owe money, then you can only collect out of the person who owes you Beinonit. If you're a woman collecting a ketuvah, the most you can take, if you have alternatives and he has no cash, is Ziburit. Rabbi Meir Omer, as Rabbi Meir argues on that piece, and he says a ketuvah tisha is like any other debt, and it's Beinonit. Furthermore, section 2. Ein nifra'im nechasim mishu'ubadim b'makom sheyesh nechasim b'nei chorin v'afilu ein ziburit. So the klal is that doesn't matter what nechasim were due you originally that you have a lien against. What's first important is that you take what's available, whatever it is. Then, if there's nothing else available, you start going after the property that has been sold. And again, it's in reverse order of how it's been sold. Because remember, every piece of property that was sold with the person who bought it doing due diligence to recognize that there was property sufficient to cover your debts that was left behind. So that means that all of your liens are going down. Every time a piece of property is sold, the liens now are all accruing to the property that's left you, whatever it is, Edis, Beninis, Iburis, that's irrelevant. That's called the property that's available. When you run out of that property, the last property sold is the next level that can be collected. Until finally, if there's still debts left, then you go all the way back to the lien that originally was on the first property that you sold, if necessary. But always the due diligence is meant to be able to protect a buyer who made certain that there was enough property left to collect from. Therefore, even though you had rights to collect that property, part of the tikkun olam to allow real estate transactions to proceed in a market that people are not terrified of getting into because they can't recoup their losses, that makes us allow your collection only from b'nei chorin. Next section of the Mishnah, section 3. Ein nifra'im minichse yetomim ela min aziburit. New halacha. If you're coming to collect from the person who owes you the nezek, who owes you the loan, who owes you as your ex-husband, so then those are the dinim. But if you're coming to collect from his heirs, who are yetomim, then you can only collect from the lowest level of property that they have available now. Next section. So this next section teaches us that the case of a sale of property, which the guy does his due diligence, he has to be protected from the types of claims that are unpredictable and have no limits. And therefore, these three cases where there's no way for him to protect himself, which will destroy the real estate market. I'm not going to buy a field from a guy who's married. I mean, what happens if he's got to pay for support, for child support? What happens if he's got to pay his wife's parnasa for 35 years and he dies young? And they're going to come to me to take my property when I have nowhere to recoup that. Forget it. So therefore, in order to make certain that you don't destroy the market by having these unforeseeable and non-limited expenses that might be due against your property that you bought in good faith, b'pnei tikkun ha'olam, we tell me to pay for your wife's mazon ha'isha, to pay for child support, to pay in the event that that person that you bought from had stolen a field, sold it to someone who then invested and built a shopping center on it, and then the original owner came and took it back and was only paid back for his expenses. Now this guy who sold that, can you believe it? The guy never had a penny in his life. He's being sued for $20 million because now he's responsible for the losses that this person took on the shopping center that he bought. How am I supposed to know that this guy, he's a pauper? How in the world could he possibly have gotten in for $20 million? Exactly. That's the point. And so because of that, these type of unforeseeable and limitless claims cannot be allowed against property that has been sold to someone who did in proper faith his full due diligence. And the next closing section is called, this is of course something that the Goyim finally managed to catch up on after 3,000 years, it's called Good Samaritan Laws. So this is another Tikkun HaOlam. Tikkun HaOlam is, you find something and you go to great trouble to return it. And as usual, the mamzer that you return it to says, and wait a minute, there was another $100 in this wallet. How come you're only giving me back a wallet with $500? I had $600. Oh my God. So now he's suing you because you were kind enough to give him back his wallet. So now he's suing you and you're going to have to make a shvuah. That's all. Forget it. Next time I see a wallet, I walk right by it. Okay. So mipnei tikkun ha'olam. This is one of the many Good Samaritan laws, which of course we don't believe there are Good Samaritans, but okay. But what the Goyim call Good Samaritans, Kishitasam, that took them so long to figure out. So this is the closing clause of the Mishnah. Now let's examine in the Gemara today how in the world we could have claimed that this is Mipnei Tikkun Olam. Let's take the first case. First case is that someone who's collecting for damages gets to collect from Idit. Now that's not Tikkun Olam, man. That's a Beferish Apostle. Meitav Sadehu, Umeitav Karmo Yishalem. Right? Now, as far as I know, gentlemen, the Good Samaritan laws protect a person who was kind enough to provide a bottle of cold water for Barnea and protects him from being sued by that very bottle. Can you imagine? To be tortured at needing to drink. Is that not a tikkun olam? Asks the Gemara. Meitav sadeu, meitav karmo yishalem is a beferish pasuk in the Torah. How did that become a tikkun olam? What are you talking about? Omer Abaye, I'll tell you, it still works out. Let's assume that our Mishnah is going according to Rabbi Yishmael. Now, Rabbi Yishmael holds that Meitav Sadehu. Who Sadehu? Aha. Can you tell me who the pronoun is referring to? Ah, says Rabbi Yishmael. It's referring to the damagee, not the damager. It's referring to the nizek. So therefore, what it's saying is, the mazik never needs to pay back with higher quality land than the land that is owned by the person that he's paying. He can tell him, why should you take my best land if my worst land is even better than your best land? Ha! So I'm going to pay you my worst land. So that's Rabbi Yishmael Shita, that the pronoun of Meitav Sadehu is the person who was damaged and not the person who is paying. Therefore, Midiraita, we would say that the Masa can get away with paying whatever is the level of quality, which is the Nizik's best. Kamashmalan, therefore, says the Mishnah, even Alibid Rabbi Yishmael, the Rabbanim made a takana mipnei tikuna olam, and they don't want people getting away with murder when they cause damage to be able to pay their lowest quality properties. We want people to suffer when they weren't careful at protecting the world from damage from their no good shor or their broken brakes on their car or whatever. So they are going to have to pay back their own best property, and they'll say to themselves, oh man, I better be careful. I may lose my very best. That's a tikkun olam. But midiraisa ino chinami. It wouldn't be true that he would have to pay his best. What, I'm really sorry, but I just sort of forgot that sugya. Would you remind me? What do you mean when you say Rabbi Yishmael? What Rabbi Yishmael? My Rabbi Yishmael. Well, here's the basis of that machlokes, the Tanya. The Braita discusses the actual pasuk of Meitav Sadehu, Meitav Karmo Yishalem. Who is the who? So, says Rabbi Yishmael, Meitav Sadehu means Shal Nizek. Meitav Karmo means Shal HaNizek. Divrei Rabbi Yishmael. Whereas Rabbi Akiva says, no. The Torah was only coming to collect Nezikin from the Idis. Now, that is a ridiculous statement if our understanding of Rabbi Yishmael is correct, isn't it? I mean, he agreed to that. He was just defining who the Idis was. This is a very funny thing to say, what Rabbi Akiva is saying. It sounds like what Rabbi Akiva is saying, no, the Torah is only coming to tell you what property to collect from, not what you have to pay for. That's what it sounds like, which means that Rabbi Akiva would have understood Rabbi Yishmael as saying that you always have to pay, if you damage someone, you have to pay the value of the best property that he's got as if you damaged it instead of the crummy property that you did damage, which is shocking. But I mean, I don't know how else we're going to understand the words of Rabbi Akiva, right? No, that's not what the Torah is coming to say. Torah is only coming to say what type of property you use to pay, not the amount. So now, what exactly does this mean? Let's go into the details. So in our Braita, it turns out that apparently, and we've got this weird additional point, and kavachomer lehegde, which sounds like if you have to pay from your own edit, certainly if you're going to pay to Hegdish and not just to Stam a Shmo, for sure you're going to have to pay from your own edis. Okay, that's what it sounds like. Now let's go back and try to understand. Did Rabbi Shmuel mean what Rabbi Akiva implies? That if you ate the highest quality of his property, so you would be paying, let's say you damaged 1 square inch of that property and it's worth $10. Ocho Shmina Mishalim Shmina. So if you ate from the worst quality property he's got, you'd also pay the same $10, even though it's only worth $5? How is that possible? Why would you be paying more than you damaged? Omer Avidi Ba'arvi, no, of course, does mean that. It means, Hachmai Askinan, Kigon Sha'achla Aruga, Bein Ha'arugot, Velo Yadinan, Ikechu Sha'achal, Ishmeina Achal. Now, let's imagine a case where this guy's got this beautiful garden. Right now, he's got different rows in the garden. Some of these rows are fabulously productive. They've got these beautiful things in them. Your favorite tomatoes, award-winning tomatoes that were just at the state fair. My God, this guy's got a display of his best tomatoes. The other rows have some failed peppers in them. Now, I don't know. There's a row missing now that your animal has managed to eat it all up. What was in that row? Well, have you got a video? No. Okay, so what are you going to pay? This guy's claiming, what do you mean? I had my award-winning tomatoes. Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe all you had were those failed peppers. So maybe that's what it's saying. If I don't know, so then I have to take the fall. Maybe that's what it means. So there we're talking that your animal ate up a row, but we don't know what it was. There's all kinds of different rows here. So then it's telling me, if you don't know, so then, Meitav Sadeo Yishalem. Oh, my Rava, that is absolutely ridiculous. You haven't gotten anywhere, excuse me. I understand. So fine. So you don't know. And if you would have known, Ilo Yadina de Kakusha Akal, supposing you had known that this was a very poor quality row. So then we're all agreed that, of course, you don't pay more than you damaged. So then, Mishalem Kakusha. Now you're telling, well, since you don't know, you pay more. Well, I got news for you. There is a fundamental principle that Moshe Rabbeinu taught when he went up to Har Sinai. And what he said was to everyone, listen, I got a very important chavrusa right now, so I'm leaving. If somebody has got any problems, you know that you can go to Aaron and Hur. These guys, they know what to do. Mi ba'al dvarim yigash aleihem. The Gemara Darshan said that means Yagish Aleihem, bring your rayas. Now, from there, we derive a fundamental principle. Do not treat cases the way that Israeli Supreme Courts treat cases, by reasonability. No, bring proof. That's called Hamotzi Michavero Alav Haraya. And therefore, says Rava, what are you helping me? You're telling me that the Torah violates one of the most fundamental, cherished principles of law. You don't take money from somebody unless you can prove that he owes that money. Therefore, I promise you, Reb Yishmael never dreamt of such a nutty situation. And he certainly never meant to say what you think Rabbi Akiva implied he was saying. He never meant to say that you're going to pay according to the value of what the best property is in the Nizik. That's absurd. He meant exactly what we said before. You pay the value of what you damaged. It has nothing to do with who owns what kind of property. Or you pay the value of what you can prove that was damaged. But what do you pay it out of? That's the question. So, Ela Amar Rav Acha Bar Yaakov, what we're talking about is, we've got a case where the Nizik owns his highest level of property that he owns, this poor guy, on his poor quality farm, is the same as the absolutely lowest level of property that the Mazik owns. And now this Nizik says, well, Mr. Mazik, I want to take your best field, because the Torah says you have to pay your best field. And Mr. Mazik says, no, I will pay you the best field that you own, which happens to be the same as my worst field, but you ain't getting more than that. And that, says Rabbi Yishmael, is correct. That over there, Rabbi Yishmael savar ben nizik shaminan, Rabbi Akiva savar ben mazik shaminan. And that is basically the explanation.